This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And I've been thinking a lot about freedom lately and how we think about that word. In one conception, freedom means not having to wear a mask when you go to a store or a movie theater. The flip side of that is having the freedom to go to a store or a theater without fearing you'll be infected with a potentially deadly virus. Freedom can also mean being able to buy whatever firearms one wants, whenever one wants to buy it. Or it can mean not living in a society where more and more public places have to install airport-level security, from government buildings to schools, on account of that freedom to acquire military-grade weapons. So what exactly is meant by freedom, and how we live our best lives with that idea at its core, is one of the many subjects addressed in the new book, Choosing Freedom, A Kantian Guide to Life. And the Kant of the title is, of course, Immanuel Kant, one of the giants of Western philosophy. And although he did his writing and thinking more than two centuries ago, my guest says his ideas are still quite relevant to modern life. Karen Storr is the author of Choosing Freedom. She's also on the faculty at Georgetown University, where she's the Ryan Family Professor of Metaphysics and Moral Philosophy, Director of Undergraduate Studies in Philosophy, and a Senior Research Scholar at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics. Karen Storr, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, as ever, you can join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you want to engage with some ideas about what Kant has to teach us about modern life, maybe you've seen him referenced on The Good Place, that TV show from a few years back, and want to ask a philosophy professor about that, this is the time to call in, 800-222-9455. So let's just start with some of the basics. Who was Immanuel Kant?
So Immanuel Kant is a Prussian philosopher from the 18th century. He is certainly very famous in the world of philosophy, maybe not so famous outside of it, but his ideas have had tremendous resonance throughout the Western world and really the history of Western thought.
Right. And since we don't have time for, obviously a graduate seminar on Kant, which certainly one could do, or maybe even an entire graduate course of study, can you just share your thumbnail sketch of how he sees humankind?
Absolutely. So Kant is well known for his focus on reason. And for Kant, the most important thing about human beings is our capacity for rational thought and rational action. And Kant was really an optimist about the possibility of reason to help us order our lives and our communities and create an environment in which each of us can really grow and flourish and live up to our potential. And so his ethics are all about trying to create such an environment for each of us as individuals, and also for our communities. That could be our local communities, our political communities, our neighborhoods, all any of those.
And he sees us as crooked timber, right? Crooked wood.
Yes. Yes. Kant famously describes us as crooked timber. So Kant thought that human beings, as I say in the book, basically we're kind of a hot mess. And that's not because we're like all bad people. It's just that we have a lot of things going on in our lives on the inside and on the outside. And that includes just like a whole mess of emotions and attitudes and self-interest and all of those kinds of things. And Kant thought it's pretty hard to be a good person. Each of us has it within us to be good, but we really have to work at it. And human nature, Kant thinks, is not really on our side. We have to do a lot of battling with the not so great parts of ourselves in order to become good.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get into some of those ideas, maybe we can just situate the context of this book. It's part of a series, sort of, I guess, ancient wisdoms for modern times, maybe you'd say. One is on the Buddha. There's another one on a book in the series on existentialists. You know, there are obviously shelves and shelves of books dedicated to telling modern humans how to live. What does Kant have on them that makes engaging with his ideas worthwhile?
Yeah, Kant may not seem like an obvious choice here for lots of reasons, partly just because his texts are pretty intimidating, but his ideas are just super interesting. And the way in which he frames the sort of the ethical challenges facing us in terms of respect and self-respect and dignity and equality, these are all concepts that still matter just as much as they ever did. And Kant's way of characterizing our ethical obligations and commitments in those terms has had a lot of staying power over over the last several hundred years. And they're really useful for trying to unpack some of our current ethical problems and complexities.
Yeah. So the title of your book is Choosing Freedom. What do you mean by freedom in that context?
Yeah, that is a graduate seminar for sure. So Kant distinguishes between two ways of thinking about being free. One is where sort of nobody is interfering with us. We're all familiar with that sense of freedom, where we're not being determined in our actions, or nobody is constraining us or coercing us. So that is a really
important. We can just be clear and say that's the mask mandate, right? This is freedom from masks. Yeah.
That's right. Yes. So that is a really important type of freedom. No question about that. But Kant has another sense of freedom that is actually more important. And that is a sense of freedom that is linked to his concept of autonomy or self-legislation or self-rule. Kant thinks that in order to be truly free, you have to be living in accordance with principles of reason. So a lot of the time when we're just doing what we want, we're not actually living in accordance with our own judgments about what we should be doing. And for Kant, even if nobody is like forcing us to spend all day on Instagram or, you know, play solitaire more than we should, that doesn't mean that we're acting freely. What it is to be free is to sort of take hold of your life and live in accordance with principles that you set for yourself.
This is, and you have the example in the book of sitting on the couch, eating Doritos, firing off disparaging tweets about people you don't like. In one sense, you can see where, yes, I have the freedom to do that. I can do what I want. I can eat what I want. I can say what I want. But on the other hand, are you really, you know, to use the modern parlance, living your best life, right?
Right. Yeah. For Kant, that is not the best life, or almost certainly isn't the best life. And we've all had this experience, I think, of sort of finding ourselves, you know, just procrastination is a great example of this. You know, we're like, I really should be doing this thing, but I'm not doing it. We all experience that as a kind of like tug, in some sense, between our, what we might call our better selves and the self that wants to sit on the couch and not do the hard thing. And for Kant, sort of in some ways, ethics is all about getting off the couch and doing the hard thing. And when we do that, he thinks that's when we're really free. So freedom for Kant can actually be a kind of constraint, but it's a self-constraint that we impose on ourselves and that we come together with other people to impose on ourselves collectively.
So one of Kant's big ideas, as compared with other moral philosophers, as I understand it, is that we can reason our way to morally good decisions. And this seems fundamental to the approach. So can you say more about that?
Yes. So Kant is a real optimist about the possibilities of human reason. And I think maybe especially in the current stage that we're in, where we might be skeptical about this, wonder whether reason can really prevail, whether we can make progress as a society using reason as the basis of our arguments. But Kant believes that this is our best hope, basically, and really our only hope. Kant thinks that all of morality is based in rationality, not in religion, not in human nature, not in our feelings, not in our preferences. It's based on our capacity for reason. And Kant thought that this is the way in which we can come to understand what morality is and act according to its obligations. So he develops in his ethical theory an account of this sort of fundamental principle of morality that he calls the categorical imperative. And that is a principle of reason. And he thinks that all human beings can understand that principle and live in accordance with it if only we use our reason well.
Yeah, you're going to have to lump me in with the people who look around at America today and really at the world today and maybe think, to borrow a phrase from one of Kant's contemporaries, that we are not in an age of reason. But okay, let's get into the categorical imperative. I suspect, you know, this is something that I think a lot of us would love to have the aphorism or three aphorisms of the book, but it's more complicated than that, right?
It is, yes. I wish it were that simple. It would be a lot easier to teach. But the idea behind this principle is that each of us has a certain kind of what we might call moral status. And the way in which Kant talks about the status is that each of us has dignity. And to have dignity means that there are certain ways in which you need to think about yourself and other people need to treat you and vice versa. So to have dignity is to have a kind of value, but it's the same value that every other rational agent has. And so for Kant, the categorical imperative is a way of trying to articulate what it means to act as if everybody has this value, if everybody has this dignity. Because Kant thinks that to have dignity means that other people are required to treat us as rational beings. And that has a lot of implications. It means that we can't kill people, steal from them, lie to them, otherwise abuse or manipulate them. It also means that we have to take seriously their projects and their goals. There's a lot that follows from that. And so Kant's whole ethical system is could be understood as trying to work out what does it really mean to treat ourselves and other people as having dignity and respecting people's dignity? What does that look like?
Yeah, there was a stand-up comedian some years ago who came pretty close to this idea. He said, you should act in a way that if everyone acted that way, things would work out. And it reminds me a little bit of the Sermon on the Mount, do unto others whatever you would have them do unto you, but it's distinguishable, right? Can you talk about why it's not really the same thing and why it's maybe not an aphorism suitable for a poster?
Yeah. So the do unto others is like sort of close to the idea. It's a little bit different in part because for Kant, the goal isn't just like, okay, I'm going to do to them whatever I would want done to me, because that makes it too much about me in some ways. It's really about them. So the fact that I would like something for my birthday, say, doesn't mean that somebody else is going to like the same thing. We all know this, of course, when we're buying gifts. And so for Kant, what really matters for respect is treating people in accordance with their ideas about what is good for them. Now, this doesn't mean that you just have to do whatever other people want. It's not like that. But Kant thinks that truly respecting people means respecting them in the use of their own reason. And that means not deciding that you know better than them what they should do or what they should want. So it's a little bit different from the do unto others because it's more focused on the other person's capacity and right to sort of determine their own life.
And kind of empathizing and trying to understand their perspective.
Yeah, that is really important for Kant. I mean, there are limits to this, right? Because Kant does think that when we're talking about our treatment of others, there are these constraints about respect. And so the mere fact that somebody wants something doesn't mean that I have to do it for them. It will depend, right? Maybe what they want is bad. Like maybe they want to rob a bank or something. I certainly don't have to help them with that. Mm-hmm. But really respecting people for Kant means giving each of us space to use our rationality and also taking our own rationality quite seriously. So Kant thinks that this sort of the principle or the idea behind the do unto others or Kant's idea that you should, what he says, universalize your uh-huh. maxims is that you have to think not just about what you want to do and your own desires and interests, sure. but also how things would be if everybody just acted on their own interests and desires.
I need to interrupt you. We have to take a break and we will continue with Karen Storr in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Karen Storr, who's the Ryan Family Professor of Metaphysics and Moral Philosophy at Georgetown University, among other appointments there. She's also the author, most pertinent to our conversation today, of Choosing Freedom, A Kantian Guide to Life. It's part of a series of books that looks at what you might call ancient wisdom for modern times, what philosophers of the past, and so far at least, have to teach us about living a good life today. And 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455. And I'm sorry, I had to interrupt you. We're on a fixed clock on this show to take that break. I don't know if you wanted to pick up where we left off or we can move on in the conversation.
We can certainly move on.
All right. Well, so let's get into some of the nitty-gritty then, because you break down some of Kant's ideas into, right, vices. He's very concerned with things we should be sort of fighting within ourselves, inner demons, if you will. And then a little later, we can talk about some of the life goals. But I thought maybe we could just go through some of these vices. The first one you write about is servility, right? Not acting like a doormat.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite vices in Kant because it's so interesting. So as we were saying before the break, Kant thinks that self-respect is very important. He actually thinks it's just as important as respecting other people. He thinks that you really have to be aware of your own value before you can fully appreciate the value of other people. And Kant thinks there's different ways we can go wrong with self-respect. We could sometimes have maybe not too much of it exactly, but we could like think too highly of ourselves. Servility is the opposite. Servility is not thinking highly enough of yourself, not sort of claiming your due from other people, or not treating yourself as being as important as you really are. And it makes it a really fascinating vice because it's something that is actually pretty common, but that really impedes our capacity to be morally good people for Kant.
That's so interesting. And it's the flip side of arrogance, as you say. Why is it that, say more about servility and how that sort of impedes us functioning in the world, you know, in the right way in Kant's view?
So we're probably all familiar with people who let others walk all over them. I mean, we all have these tendencies ourselves in some ways, or most of us do. And there's a lot of reasons behind this, but Kant thinks basically that we shouldn't do that, that we need to be able to recognize in our interactions with others that we are equally important, not more important, but just as important as anyone else. And if we don't fully appreciate that, Kant thinks, we're not really going to be in the right sort of frame of mind to engage with other people as equals. So just like imagine a friendship that is very one-sided, where one person takes advantage of the other and the other person doesn't stand up for themselves. Kant's going to say that's not a great relationship. Not just like on a personal level, but also on a moral level. In order to have really good moral relationships, we have to sort of be in the right relationship with ourselves, we might say.
All right, I want to look at another one of these vices, which is contempt. And this one really struck me because the idea is looking down on people. And you say Kant would want us to refrain from expressing contempt, even for people who very much deserve it. And the example you cite in the book is the sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. It did make me think I would love to see what Kant would make of Twitter, where contempt seems to be one of the dominant modes. But talk about why is contempt such a vice for Kant?
Yeah, Kant, I think, would say that contempt is probably one of the most dangerous vices there is, because what contempt does is sort of put us in a mindset that other people are worthless. And he recognizes that sometimes maybe that's not entirely wrong, or there's some sense in which it's not wrong, but there's another sense in which Kant thinks it is wrong, because he thinks it's just not true, that anyone is truly worthless. He really believed that everybody had the capacity for reform in them, even if they won't always live up to it. But even setting that aside, Kant would just say it's a really bad thing for us as humanity to take a position that some of us are worthless. And because of that, Kant thinks we need to erase contempt from our interactions with other people.
So as I was thinking about contempt, as you describe it in the book, I started seeing it everywhere in our politics, in media, in our criminal justice system, even in popular entertainment, like certain reality TV shows. Do you think we're in a generally contemptuous culture now?
I think there's a lot of it out there, and social media probably makes it worse. It's not like contempt is new. It's been around for a very long time, but social media has ways of amplifying it and anonymizing it that I think can make it even more challenging, both to recognize and also to uproot. I think Kant would say that contempt is just incompatible with trying to be members of a moral community, because what contempt is doing is trying to sort of push people out of a community, being like, you are not worth talking to, listening to, dealing with, you are just not part of the community that is engaging with each other. And Kant thinks that we don't actually really have the right to exclude anyone from the broader moral community that way. I mean, we can exclude people from our friend groups, but we can't just say to someone, you're out of here. And insofar as modern culture makes it really easy to do that, then it's going to be a pretty bad place for us.
All right, let's go to the phones. 800-222-9455. We're speaking with Karen Storr, who's the author of Choosing Freedom, A Kantian Guide to Life. 800-222-9455. And Tom is calling from Champaign. Tom, thank you for calling in.
Yes, I just wanted to go back to the very top of your talk. you stressed that rationale and reasoning was so central to Kant's idea. But, of course, philosophers back to the pre-Socratics have also stressed the use of reason and rationality. So how does Kant's concept of reason differ from previous philosophers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Kant, as he, I think, would be the first to admit, owes a great debt to the philosophers who came before him, and maybe most especially Plato, although also the Stoics. So like all philosophers, Kant is drawing on a tradition, and it's a tradition that has always emphasized the significance of reason. One of the things that makes Kant a little bit different from, say, Plato is that for Kant, his faith in human reason is also tied to his recognition that a lot of what we're doing and our assumptions is actually kind of opaque to us in some ways. And so there's lots of puzzles for Kant about how reason actually operates and how we know when we're using it and using it well. But there's definitely big affinities between Kant and some of those earlier philosophers, like I said, especially Plato.
All right, Tom, thank you so much for the call. Great question. Moving down the list of returning to the vices, another one, I mean, we can maybe go through some of these because they're kind of related, but defamation, mockery, making fun of others, spreading gossip, bending the truth, being deceitful with people. These are all things that, again, in Kant's view, interfere with us sort of living our best lives, to put it in the modern parlance.
Yeah. So, I mean, Kant thinks that as human beings, we kind of find it hard not to hate people sometimes. It's just sort of the way we are. And so a lot of his discussion of vices is focused on us trying to overcome that tendency in ourselves. And so he thinks things like mocking people or spreading, you know, nasty gossip or spreading rumors just for the fun of it has a way of sort of feeding our own deep desire to feel superior to other people. And Kant thinks this is a big threat to morality. It's a threat to our appreciation of everybody's dignity. And so for that reason, Kant thinks that we really need to make sure that our social interactions aren't sort of reflecting those inner, that inner like sort of pleasure that we take in feeling superior to other people. And so a lot of what he says about vice is tied to that. Now, Kant is also pretty well known for his deep opposition to lying. And that has an interestingly different basis. And it has to do with the importance that Kant placed on truth-telling and trust in our relationships with other people, which for Kant is really central to our capacity to basically do anything at all, which is why he thinks that truth-telling is such a fundamentally important thing and why a tendency to lie is such an incredibly bad vice.
All right. So after the vices, then Kant does have, and I think you say in the book that he's perhaps better known for, you know, the sort of prescriptive is the right term, but, you know, this idea of things we should be doing, right? Personal development is one. You talk about Stoic cheerfulness. Maybe that's a good one, because Stoic cheerfulness is something that I also think maybe can be in short supply sometimes in our current society.
Yeah, I love this section of Kant. So going back to Tom's point about what Kant has drawn on from ancient traditions, Kant was influenced by the Stoics. And as listeners may know, the Stoics really emphasize a certain kind of independence, in particular, an independence from wants and desires that we can't fulfill. So Kant picks up on this because he thinks this is really important to our freedom. And if we think about just like being the kind of person that can get really worked up or upset about little things like a traffic jam or like a really slow customer service experience or a canceled flight or gas prices. There are a lot of things that can be really aggravating. And Kant thinks that the more that we let those things get the better of us, the less free we are. And so part of cultivating that kind of freedom, a capacity to live an autonomous, self-controlled life, is going to be about learning to cultivate a capacity to bear with minor and major hardships with some degree of sort of equanimity or even cheerfulness, if you can pull it off, though that's pretty hard.
Yeah, sure can be. Another one in this section is our time is only about 3 minutes left in our conversation, but one that really struck me is judicious reserve, knowing when to shut up. I mean, I am literally a talk show host. that is a key skill for me, but one that it's taken a long time to develop. We'll leave it up to my friends and family to say whether I have. But say more about judicious reserve.
Yeah, I also talk for a living. Right. Kant thinks we should not say everything that's on our minds, mostly because it's just not fit to be said. A lot of it, some of it is, but not all of it is. We need filters. Kant thinks that filters are so important, both so we don't just mess up and say insulting things because we're in a bad mood, but also to preserve that kind of sense that I described before, that reminder that we all have dignity, that we all have value. And reserve is important to that. It helps us remember that we're supposed to be respecting each other and ourselves.
All right. I want to ask you big picture about writing a book like this. I noticed the text has a lot of caveats along the lines of this is an oversimplification or in a nutshell. It struck me that you were kind of doing a, what's the phrase? Not rebuttal, but pre-buttal, so to speak. Do you worry writing a book that's more geared at a general audience about having your sort of serious philosopher card revoked?
Not really. It's the same thing as with teaching, right? You're trying to sort of speak to your audience, whoever it is. And of course, my hope is that people will end up wanting to read a lot more Kant and get really into those nuances. But realistically, most won't. And so I think for this book was really a labor of love in many ways, because I was just trying to think, this is what's so cool about Kant. This is what makes him worth thinking about and studying. And if people never do more than read a couple chapters from the book, I'm thrilled with that. If they want to go on to study Kant, even better. But it's fine if they don't.
It seems like he did not lend him. So I almost feel like you're writing the book that maybe a lot of people, you know, wish he would have written, right? That sort of synthesized and brought everything together, because he contradicts himself a lot, right?
He does. I mean, we all do. So yeah. Kant is not alone in this, but he's definitely really hard to make sense of. And, you know, not everybody has time to spend their entire lives sorting through Kant's text. So, but it doesn't mean that we can't use parts of it or use his ideas to help us think about our own lives. And so the book is an attempt to sort of create that bridge between the actual kind of hard to read and complicated and somewhat boring, sometimes Kant, and the amazingly interesting ideas that I think are valuable for us living our lives now.
Well, I will say to listeners, if you are curious about philosophy, if you enjoyed The Good Place, and if you are maybe beyond the point where you will be signing up for any graduate seminars, this is a good entry. The book is Choosing Freedom, A Kantian Guide to Life. Karen Storr is the author. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about your work today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about a new report that looked at Thompson Prison in Illinois. This was built as a state prison, never used. After many years of negotiations, it was transferred to the federal government. And a new report says bad things have been happening there, human rights abuses, that sort of thing. We're going to talk with the investigators behind that story tomorrow on the 21st Show. The 21st is produced by Erica Scalise and Aidan Choate. Our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. I want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org. You can let us know what you thought about today's program, suggest future topics. You can also find links to our podcasts. Again, that's 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.